Good morning.
Good morning.
This is one of those embarrassing Sundays where I have to confess that I left my talk at work. So I'm going to do it on the fly based on my memory of what I thought I wrote. Otto, do me a favor. Chant one round of the great vows.
Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Dharmas are boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.
Thank you. So, for those of you who weren't here last week, I talked about just the title, Great Vows for All, and went into somewhat of a discussion about that, each word and how they all go together. What I'd like to do is, I have to do this again, like I said, by memory, and I don't have the actual quote, but there's a well-known Chinese Zen master and also a poet named Ikkyu, I-K-K-Y-U. And he was pointing out how at monasteries, he was a wandering monk. He didn't stay in one place for too long. He was talking about how in monasteries, the monks and the teachers were so serious about practicing their rituals, and particularly chants, every day, day after day after day, very serious about doing that. And Ikkyu was a drunk, actually. And a drunken poet, so he was a free spirit, I guess, as we say. I guess in today's terms, we would look at it differently in terms of recovery and all that, but he sort of frowned upon the seriousness with which chants were done because they left out the spirit of the chant. And he said something to the effect that these monks should have to listen to the love letters sent by the wind, the rain, the moon, and the stars before they begin their chant. They should be asked to listen to the love letters sent by the wind, the rain, the moon, and the stars before they begin their chant. So let's listen to this chant and let's take up talking about this chant with that spirit. You know, there's a spirit that's embodied in these words. It's not just dead words that we recite. You know, it's not a list of rules to live by that have no life to them. So the first line is, creations are numberless, I vow to free them. And as I've mentioned, there's a number of different ways that these are presented. Another one is, creations are numberless, I vow to save them. And when I hear it chanted that way, it always reminds me, I can't remember the city, but somewhere on the outside of a church, there's a sign, a flashing sign that you see at night, a neon sign that says, Jesus saves. And I think that one of the reasons that the language was changed from save to free was, if I'm going to save somebody just by making that statement, I've already created a separation. God, there's something that I'm really going to be able to do for you to make your life better. And it also subtly makes me one up, somehow better than you. But I'm going to somehow do something for you that bring you along. Now that problem exists, I think, also if I vow to free you. So the first thing that I would say when we take up creations are numberless and I vow to free them is that creations refer to every living being, including ourselves, and that we are all not separate from each other. Now, one of the things that has come up in the past is, my God, what a commitment this is. What a vow this is. We're talking about numberless creations that we're taking a responsibility to somehow participate in freeing those creations. How enormous that is. And it reminded me of a line, I don't know where this comes from, but somebody once said that all we can do is our part, and all else is fantasy leading to exhaustion. So I think part of the spirit of this vow is all we can do is our best. All we can do is our part to contribute to our mutual freedom, to our mutual awakening. We have to make ourselves crazy. Now again, that's the spirit of it, not the literal interpretation. So when we vow to save all beings, I think the heart of that is that what we're doing is we're vowing to do two things. One is to support each other on the path to awakening. And the other is we're doing the best we can to clean up our own act so that we don't create any negative karma that affects someone else that gets in their way. So free them. Free them, I think, means to remove in whatever way we can any obstacles that may prevent people from awakening. And at the same time, not creating any obstacles that might get in their way. Now, it occurred to me, I had an interesting experience. I wasn't thinking of this talk or the great vows at all when this happened. But a number of years ago, I've mentioned this in talks, I did a street retreat, a homeless retreat with Bernie Glassman. We stayed in a shelter and lived on the street for a number of days. And also, as a social worker, I've run a number of programs over the years for homeless people. So I have some familiarity and some comfort level with people who are homeless. So that's one ingredient in this story. The other ingredient is, I was talking to a client, a private practice client, who was talking about his family of origin and how invisible he was. His family didn't really see him. He was sort of quiet. He was a middle child. He didn't get much attention. He was invisible, and how lonely that felt. And I know from, you know, doing work as a social worker with homeless people that one of the things that comes up is, you know, people sitting on the street or begging, how invisible they feel, how people just walk by. Nobody pays attention. We just walk by. You know, we don't want to have anything to do with it. So in this past week, I was looking to buy a gift, and I came to Montclair. And I was walking on Church Street, of all places. And there was a young guy sitting on the sidewalk right in front of Raymond's. And he had a piece of cardboard, and on the cardboard said, "Homeless Iraqi vet, please help." And he had a little thing there to put money in. And as I was walking by, so I was in this other place in myself, you know, I was thinking of presents and, you know, what am I going to do? And I saw this guy, and I found myself, I could feel myself shutting him out, you know, like I just, I didn't want to have anything to do with this, you know. And so I kept walking, you know, I sort of ignored him, made him, as they say, invisible. I disconnected myself from a part of myself. And so I went on looking for my present, but it started nagging me because I realized what I had just done. I had contributed to this guy, this young guy's experience of being invisible. So eventually I went back, and he was still there. And he had, like I said, this cardboard thing. He had a backpack and had a book that he was reading. He didn't say anything even when I walked by. He was just sitting there silently. And I sat down next to him. And I asked him, how are you doing? I introduced myself. I said, "Hi, my name's Carl. I'm just curious, how are you doing?" And I struck up a conversation with him. And you know, I asked him questions about his service in Iraq, and not in an embarrassing way, but ask him how he became homeless. And his story was that when he came home from Iraq, he had a girlfriend at home. She had finished college, and she had dumped him. And he had gotten a job working for a construction company. He's originally from Nutley. And he had gotten the job working for a construction company, building in some kind of environmentally sound housing. And then he got laid off. The government funds for the program terminated, and he got laid off. And then he was living with a friend, and the friend lost his job, and that friend lost his apartment and had to go live with his family. But this guy could not go. And so he had no job, no money. He had been living off his friend, and he was literally on the street. So he went to the Salvation Army to see if he could get a bed for the night. Now, let me say that sleeping in a shelter, you know, like a lot of times you say, well, yeah, why don't you just send him to a shelter? Living in a shelter is not a great place to stay, having firsthand experience of this. It's not safe in many ways. People steal your stuff. There are people who are mentally ill during the night when you're trying to sleep. There are people yelling and talking to themselves. So it's not a great gig. But anyway, he had been waiting. He was on a waiting list for the Salvation Army shelter. You know, I asked him about if he had any issues with alcohol or with drugs, and he said no, his only addiction was that he smoked. So Raymond's was right there. Oh, I asked the guy, I said, when's the last time you ate? And he said, yesterday. I said, so you haven't eaten at all today? And this is about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He said, no. And the reason why he was sitting here with the sign was he had saved $105 that he got from begging, and that he could get a room for a week if he came up with $150. And he hoped that if he could do that, then he could look for work. Now, there's a judgment about this. You know, there are people on the street who are hucksters or whatever the current word is. But I you know, based on my experience, I believe that he was telling me the truth. So I said, well, so you're hungry? And he said, yeah. And so here's, we're sitting in front of Raymond's. I said, well, let's get some lunch. So we got up and walked a few feet and sat down at a table, and a waitress came out. And I said to him, well, get whatever you want. So he ordered a big egg sandwich with bacon and all the stuff, and toast and a big glass of juice, you know. And at some point he said to me, I never thought I would be this full today. So he needed $45 to supposedly get this apartment. And so I gave him the 40, you know, we chatted for a while, and then before leaving, I gave him the $45. And I was a little hesitant because I'm always worried about giving cash to homeless people because you never know if they're going to use it for drugs or alcohol or something else. But I went with my judgment that it, based on having, you know, spending maybe a half hour, 45 minutes with this guy, it was probably close to the truth anyway. And he was a nice guy. I liked him, so. So now that, to me, you know, that was just one of these things where I was sort of doing my own work, you know, to, I think I've talked about trying to bear witness to the world and to my own personal process. And I caught myself, in a sense, dehumanizing this guy, making him invisible. So I went back and practiced what I preached. But now I realize, and with dealing with the Great Vows for All, in a sense, by doing my work, by trying to keep my own backyard clean, I was serving him. I was helping free him, in a sense, to become who he was. You know, so it doesn't have to be. It could be that simple act of buying somebody lunch, that where we're in the process of helping free others to become actualized, to become who they are. Just last night, Cindy was telling me this story about in the neighborhood, walking down the street, and there's this one family, they're really into gardening. We've gotten into gardening with these grandiose plans for next year to have this big garden in our yard, vegetables and all this other stuff. But anyway, so we're very conscious of it. It's in our awareness to appreciate garden. And so she this was just between her and I, she was just telling me she had left a message on their voicemail telling them how much she appreciated the their garden and how much joy it brought her. And she later ran into one of the wife of the couple who said that they had left the message on their phone the entire week because it was so uplifting to have that kind of appreciation. Well, again, to me, that's the practice of freeing each other, helping each other be free, You know, just that simple support, that simple acknowledgement. So it doesn't have to be, you know, going to a street corner and giving out a bunch of Zen platitudes or anything like that. It's much more subtle and much more simple. Anything that we do where we can relieve obstacles from somebody or support somebody to be who they are is freeing all beings or helping all beings be free. So I hope it's helpful. Thank you.